So the reading today is from Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 to 13, which is on page 694 of the Church Bibles. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." The disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist.
Thank you, Anna, very much. Well, good afternoon. Let me add my welcome to Ed's. My name's Jim Wolford. I'm on the staff here at Emmanuel. It's good to see lots of new faces around today. So do keep your Bible open. We're in Matthew 17. And we've already prayed away with the hymn we sung. But let's just pray that verse, that chorus in again. Let me lead us. Our Father, our great longing now is that you would show us Christ. Oh God, please reveal your glory through the preaching of your word so that our hearts would soundly confess that Christ is Lord. And we pray it for his name's sake. Amen. Well, I don't know who first coined the term mountaintop experience, but I guess our passage today describes a mountaintop experience to end all others. Jesus, face shining like the sun, his clothes dazzlingly white, in conversation with two guys long dead. What is it, delirium on Peter's part, or just confusion as he kind of offers to build shelters for them all? Rounded off by what seems to be the voice of God himself, with the disciples on their faces on the floor. Clearly what happened on that mountaintop was awe-inspiring. But in many ways, at least for us here today, it's very easy to hold it all at arm's length, isn't it? Much harder to get to grips with this than some of the miracles we've seen in Matthew's gospel. Like when Jesus stilled the storm or when he kind of walked on the water, because at least we can picture those in our mind's eye. Here in the transfiguration, which you've got to say even as a word sounds alien, doesn't it? It sounds churchy, oddly religious, the transfiguration. Well, in the events of the transfiguration, things just seem so bizarre, so like a dream, so like the disciples have eaten something they shouldn't and now are having a kind of strange out-of-body experience as a result, which all combines to make this a very difficult passage, whether we're a believer or not, a very difficult passage to engage with seriously. And particularly so if we're British, because here in this country we don't have much time for out-of-body experiences, do we? For instance, there was a book published just a couple of years ago in America called Heaven is for Real. You might have heard of it. It's by a chap called Todd Burpo. Todd describes an experience his 4-year-old son went through when he underwent life-threatening, an emergency surgery, an emergency operation, where his son spoke of seeing Jesus and meeting him with an eerie matter-of-factness in a way that, you know, just is totally not what you'd expect of a four-year-old. And the book, when it was written up, made it to the number one in the New York Times bestseller list, and over 2 million copies are now in print of this book. So over in the States, it made quite a splash. Here, hardly caused a ripple. Probably haven't even heard of the book. It hasn't caused a ripple. Because we Brits, well, we're just naturally far more sceptical about these sorts of things, aren't we? We don't go in for accounts of out-of-body experiences in the same way maybe others do. And you might feel that's a good thing. You might feel that's a really bad thing. But when it comes to Matthew's account here of what Peter, James, and John saw, that heavenly vision they had of Jesus, we simply can't afford to dismiss it so easily. Because it actually serves as a major building brick, a central part of the case that Matthew has been building week by week by week as we've been reading it, going through his gospel. The big case that Jesus of Nazareth is no ordinary man, but he is the Christ, the Son of the living God, God's long-promised king who the Jews had been waiting hundreds of years for. And the point this little passage is making is, yes, the king has come, and the particular aspect of his kingship that's drawn out here is his glory. It's his glory. So I've got 2 points today. Here's the first one. Jesus is the King of Glory. Jesus is the King of Glory. The thing is, glory, it's quite a slippery word, isn't it? Glory. What does it mean? Well, it essentially means brilliance. It means greatness displayed. So Usain Bolt, who was on the TV quite a lot going up preparing for the Olympics, you know, he seems, a bit of a joker, doesn't he? You know, perhaps a bit of a fool with all his sort of pre-race antics and all the rest of it. But as he runs down the track in the final of the 100 metres, he gives the world a mighty display of his glory, his brilliance. It's there for all to see. And in a way, Matthew has given us little glimpses of Jesus' glory, just tiny glimpses in describing the miracles he performed, little snapshots, a bit like you get a snapshot of Usain Bolt's glory as he just warms up maybe on the track or does some training. But here, in the Transfiguration, we get it in multicolour. We get a full-on vision of Jesus in his glory. And it comes just a chapter after we reached a crunch point when Peter was put on the spot by Jesus, and Jesus asked him, "Well, who do you say I am?" And Peter responded, it's him. It's you. You are the King, the one we've all been waiting for, the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, effectively, "Yes, that is right. But before I come in glory, before I come in all my divine majesty, I'm going to be put to death first." Well, we saw last week that this rather took the wind out of the sails of the disciples, didn't it? What? Death? Never, never. They hadn't seen it coming. This, if he was the king, well, they expected him to triumph over his enemies, not be defeated by them. And so you can see how very quickly after Jesus had told them this, disillusionment could have set in. Just little niggling doubts, wondering whether he really is who he says he is. And so just a few days later, apparently it's, what does it say, verse 1, just 6 days after telling them that he was going to die, he takes them up a mountain and lays their doubts to rest in just a matter of moments. His appearance, what are we told? Well, we're told he was transfigured. His appearance changes dramatically before them. And the best way Matthew can describe it is in terms of the sun. His face shines like the sun. Wow, the sun, you can't, on a cloudless day, when you look at the sun, you can't look at the sun. It is too bright. It's too much. That's kind of how the face of Jesus was at that moment, says Matthew. And his clothes, radiant, dazzling white. It's as though in that moment Jesus unveils himself before his disciples so they see him for who he truly is. Not just a man, but God too. The King of glory, the one who dwells in unapproachable light, standing there right before them. And the thing is, this is no random event. That's the point. It doesn't just come out the blue, which we can therefore just dismiss because it seems rather far-fetched. No, this fits neatly within the narrative, really within the flow of Matthew's gospel as a whole, because at last the disciples get it, chapter 16. What happens in they get it, chapter 16, that Jesus is God's one true king. And just when they might be tempted to doubt after what he tells them about his death, chapter 17, they get one glorious confirmation that he is who he says he is. And it's a confirmation that we need as well. Not just the disciples, but we need it as well. Because Jesus doesn't seem very glorious today, does he? As we go about life in this world, in the 21st century, he doesn't seem glorious. After all, the verdict on the world history gives on Jesus is that he was an inspirational figure, yes. Maybe something of a game changer in the context of world religions, but ultimately nothing more. Now dead and buried, just like all the other greats of world history. And with such a view swirling around the place, it's very easy to subconsciously breathe it in and sort of kind of have our faith be affected by it. Yes, we can say to ourselves, oh yeah, I know that Jesus promised that he's going to come in glory, come in the glory of his Father with all his holy angels. Yeah, I know it, but can I seriously believe it, really? Because it does sound a bit fairy tale like, if I'm honest. Fairy tale like. It not something that really tallies with real life of hard facts, you know, regular everyday realities. It doesn't seem to tally very well with that. But Matthew's contention is no, it does. This vision of a heavenly Jesus does fit with the real world of facts, of time, space, history, because this is the manner in which he writes about it. Not in picture language, not in poetry, but a straightforward report. The kind of piece that would be home on a BBC website. This, posted by Matthew, our Middle Eastern correspondent. You see, if we had lived then, just if we happened to have lived then and happened to have been on that mountain on that day, right there and then, well then we too would have seen Jesus in all his brilliance. We would have seen him. And at any other point in life, you know, you wouldn't have been able to pick him out from the crowd. Ordinary guy. Except at this one moment where he stood unmistakably the King of glory. So we've got to take this account seriously. It fits neatly within Matthew, not just within Matthew actually, but within the flow of the Bible as a whole. It's in sync with all that's come before. So take Moses and Elijah, for example. Matthew tells us about them, doesn't he, in verse 3. Jesus is talking with them. Now these two, Matthew, Moses and Elijah, they are major figures in the story of the Old Testament. For one thing, both had significant experiences of God on mountaintops at key points in their ministries. But more than that, Moses and Elijah sort of sum up all the revelation that God has given up to this point in the story of the Bible. What we know really is the Old Testament, the first kind of chunk, the first two-thirds of the Bible, the Jews of the day knew as the law and the prophets. And Moses, well, he was the chief lawgiver, and Elijah, he was chief among the prophets. So Moses and Elijah, they sum up all that God has said to his people so far. And what they spoke about, what both the law and the prophets spoke about, was the coming of a Christ. The coming of a king. So when Jesus stands there in all his kingly brilliance and talks to Moses and Elijah, no less. These two Old Testament heroes. The point is clear. The one whose roots go right back to the beginning is here. He has come. Think how encouraging that would have been for the disciples. Don't be discouraged by his determination to die. He is the glorious king of which they spoke. And then, of course, well, what is it? There's another major character in this event. It's God himself, who at a number of times in the Old Testament draws near to his people in the form of a cloud. And here he does it again like that. And the words that God speaks about Jesus is really, really interesting. They're not new words. They're words he's spoken hundreds of years before in Psalm 2 and in a book called Isaiah 42. When he prepared his people in those two particular places for the coming of the king. And now he speaks those same words, but he speaks them very directly of Jesus. This is my son, he says, verse 5. This is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. So it's just a little event that we might be tempted to kind of slightly sort of push away, but it's a little event that is laden with significance, laden with Old Testament baggage. This is not some random hallucination that the disciples had, which we can, you know, perhaps without realizing it, admittedly, but we slightly kind of discount when we go through the gospel. It is actually, it's a deliberately given, multi-layered confirmation that Jesus is the Christ. He is the King of glory. That's who he is. And so it's a vision which ought to be very precious to us. And it ought to be underlined, burning in red. I mean, the whole of the Bible ought to be underlined in red. But I guess this passage, you know, it's not something to be afraid of. It should be very precious to us indeed. Because don't you find you fall in one of two ways? You either fall towards more of a view of Jesus that is earthy, an earthy Jesus, who came as a man and died a physical death for us. Or you go the other way, and it's kind of cloud-like Jesus, which isn't really a Jesus at all, because he's substantial, he's solid, but he's up there in the heavens with God, so far beyond us in every way. We fall one of two ways, and what the Transfiguration does is it marries those two kind of misconceptions of Jesus together in the true conception of who he really is. The thing is, though, if we were just to stop there, we're kind of missing the point of what the whole events of the Transfiguration are about. Because the point of the whole thing is not just that we, not just that the disciples back then, saw Jesus as king, it was that they treated him as king. The point of it all can be summed up in the final three words that God speaks. Just look at verse 5 again, verse 5. This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. Listen to him. And after that, there's nothing. Just silence. You just imagine the disciples. They would have been shaking, wouldn't they? Shaking, quivering with fear on the floor, face down. Waiting for whatever's going to happen next in this kind of really extraordinary turn of events that they've just gone through. What's going to happen next? Nothing does. It's all quiet. And then I guess on their different shoulders they feel a hand, and someone's saying, it's Jesus saying, get up, don't be afraid. And they look up, and it's just Jesus there in his regular appearance, just looking like them, a regular guy, and no one else but him. Well, there would be no doubt in their minds, would there, as they walked back down the mountain after all this, what their life was going to be about from then on? It would be a life that hung on his every word. A life that hung on his every word. So whether they meant to or not, they could no longer now put Jesus in the dock, quietly. They couldn't do that. They could no longer take or leave what he said, depending on how they felt, depending on how what he said fitted with what they expected him to say. They could no longer set his words up against kind of the words of the Old Testament and see which one they would go with. No, his words were ultimate. It surpassed all that had gone before. And their job now is very simple. Just listen and obey. And in the 2,000 years that have passed since that moment, nothing has changed. What God said to those three disciples, he would say to us. Listen to him. Listen to him. So that's our second point today. The first was Jesus is the King of Glory. The second is, very simply, listen to the King of Glory. This simple command, this listen to the King of Glory, it really undergirds all we want to do as a church when we meet together, all that we're about. Because we don't want us to be a people who kind of can talk the talk, talk about Jesus as King. No, we want to be people who treat him as King as well. And that means paying really close attention to what he says, to his words, as we find them here in the Bible. Because we can't claim that Jesus is our King, can we, if we don't really do what he says? If he says one thing and we do another, it's kind of incongruous to claim that he is our King. Because do you remember how we defined King? King is sort of, it's a hard term in a way. It's a sort of kind of a willowy term. What does it mean? It means being in charge. That's what we said 2 weeks ago, being in charge. It means the one who's in the driving seat. The one who calls the shots. That's what it means. Which is why listening to him is so important. Because if we don't listen to the shots he calls, he's not really our King at all in any real sense. Now this is a bit of a concept that maybe young children can struggle with, because you can ask a 3-year-old who's in charge, you or daddy, and you can train them to say daddy. But in the heat of the moment, when they really don't want to go to bed, when they don't want to put on their shoes before it's time to go out. It doesn't matter how clear the instruction is, they can find all sorts of excuses not to listen. And really, we know it. It's not just young children, is it? It is all of us. We're all like that. All of us who follow King Jesus. And so that's why we want to do what we can as a church to make sure we listen to him. We've clearly heard what he says to us here in the Bible, and then call on one another to live it out. It's why, for instance, we have a question time after the sermon. It's a chance, really, to get a bit more input on a particular verse that maybe the preacher missed or whatever, or to seek clarification, or to air any objections we have. Not so we become heresy hunters or sermon hacks. No. It's so that any barriers that would otherwise keep us from living out what we've learnt from Jesus are removed. That's why we encourage conversation with one another after our main meeting is finished and as we have tea together. It's why we look at the same passage in our small groups on a Sunday rather than going for a different small group altogether. You see, on our own, certainly on my own, I can kid myself that, yes, got the message of the sermon, great, it's there. But chatting about it with others helps me, and I guess here's the point, helps them see my blind spots. And we'll think a bit more towards the end of our meeting together here about small groups and why we do them the way we do. But part of the reason behind our the way we run them is to protect Emmanuel, the desire to protect this church from ever becoming a preaching centre, ever becoming a good Bible teaching church where maybe the Bible is being taught, but none of us are really listening. Because when it comes to the words of the King, it will be very easy not to listen. It will be so easy to just switch off. Because what he says, the central thrust, the nub of what he says to us is, it's outrageous to our ears. It's utterly outrageous. Remember his words in the previous passage? This is the central call he makes on all of our lives. If anyone would come after me, that is, anyone kind of come and be in my kingdom, have me as their king, they must do what? Well, they must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Come, he's saying, come and be with me, and then come and die with me too. Oh, and that rails against us, what we want to do. But Jesus' death, you know, it's at the forefront of his mind. It's the subject he returns to as they head back down the mountain. There's a God that we had talk of Jesus' death last week, and then they got the mountain, have this experience, and then they're going back down the mountain again, and the theme is the same. We're back on Jesus' death. Did you see that, verse 9? Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Keep this quiet, because if word gets out that you've seen my kingly glory, well, no one will understand that I've got to die first. Keep it to yourselves until I've been raised from the dead. And then, a bit like a seasoned politician, he kind of returns to kind of the same message. He stays on message. When the disciples ask him a question, he returns to the theme of his death again. Just look at the question they ask. Verse 10. Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? They ask. Might seem a bit of a funny question to our ears. That's the burning question they have. But it comes from a prophecy in Elijah that says, before the Christ comes, before the king comes, Elijah will come. And he'll come, and what he'll do is he'll restore everything. But a Christ, a king who dies, which is what Jesus is saying he is, doesn't really fit with the idea of a forerunner who brings about a great spiritual restoration. How can he bring about this Elijah figure, bring about a great spiritual restoration, and then the one he prepares the way for says he's going to die? Doesn't seem to fit. Well, Jesus answers it by saying, well, this Elijah person, he's already come, actually. He's come in the form of John the Baptist. And look at what happened to him. I mean, we learned just a few chapters earlier, his head's chopped off. So why should I fare any better? That's what happened to him. Same's going to happen to me. So the theme he returns to, it's death. Death is there. And it's the very thing the disciples didn't want to hear him on. But now with a blazing vision of Jesus in their mind's eye, one that actually they could really now picture clearly, they've got nothing to fear. Nothing at all. Because here is one who can be trusted even in the face of death. Someone so awesome that they can put their hand in his and walk on the path that he takes, and the path of suffering, rejection, yes, death. But none of these things will have the final say. It's not the end of the story with this great king. Now, just thinking again about little children, they are obviously fearful about all sorts of things. It's very clear to us what they're afraid of. You know, whether it may be it's big crowds. You know, you can tell it. They hate it, or the dark, or I don't know, as we've been finding recently, the life-sized plastic dinosaurs at the zoo that are there at the moment. Well, at the same time, now we might say naively, they are wonderfully confident in the all-surpassing kind of power and trustworthiness of their parents. They just have this great trust. So yes, the child says, I'm afraid of people, but it's okay if I'm with daddy. Oh, I hate the dark, but in daddy's arms it's all right. I can walk past the Tyrannosaurus Rex if daddy's going that way and he's holding my hand, I can go with him. And in the same way, a glorious Jesus is a trustworthy Jesus, isn't he? Glorious Jesus, trustworthy Jesus. See him in all his brilliance, and we don't need to shy away from his call to deny ourselves, to take up our crosses and to follow him. Because the one who dies is the very same one who will come in glory. So we're safe if we're with him. We're safe now, we're safe forever. So what is he calling you to at the moment, at this time? Where is he calling you? Maybe that's a better opening. Where is he calling you to follow him at the moment? Is it on to the creche team, when you'd rather be in this meeting every Sunday and not have to go up there whenever it is once a month? Maybe to persevere in that difficult relationship with someone, when you'd rather, everything in you just wants to chuck it all in, call it a day, to give up that precious evening each week, when we'd rather have just a bit more time at home on our own with our husband, to be open about our struggle in a particular area of sin that we just need help with, and we'd rather kind of make light of it and just continue on without anyone knowing, into increasing the amount we give when we'd rather save more for a rainy day, into throwing our lot into the Christian Union at the start of a new year when really we'd rather just be a church on Sunday man, into possibly serving Jesus overseas when rather, you know, it's the home comforts which appeal most of all. We could go on and on and on. It will be different for all of us. But here's the big point. No matter how tough the future lies, the it seems what Jesus is calling us onto as we follow him into the future, no matter how much we might want to flee and go our own way, and don't we all want to sort of go our own way and flee? The one who calls us, though, is the King of Glory. So what could be wiser, what could be richer, what could be better than to follow him wherever he leads? Should we just have a moment of quiet and then I'll lead us in a prayer. Our Father, thank you for giving us this record of Jesus in all his glory. Lord, would you help us to help one another, to take these truths into our hearts and into our lives, that we might listen to his words and obey them in all that we do. We pray it for his name's sake. Amen.
Voice came from heaven. This is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. What's Jesus been saying to you through Matthew's gospel? What do you need to listen to and think about how that's going to change your life today? Got a chance now to reflect on that, perhaps just to pray in the quiet, perhaps to chat to somebody nearby, or to write a question that you've got on one of the post-it notes at the end of the race. Jim explained earlier, our question time gives us a chance to make sure we're just moving any sort of roadblocks there might be to us really listening to Jesus, clarifying things, just making sure we're clear what he is saying to us so that we can get on and obey him. And Jim, a couple of questions just to start that are really just sort of clarifying things. People are interested in this, in sort of Peter's response, Peter's sort of question about building shelters. What's going on there?
Yes, I didn't come to a firm conclusion on that in my prep this week. A couple of options. One, he's just beside himself and he doesn't quite know what to do. But then there's a sense of, let's build something permanent here. Let's make something long lasting about what's going on now. And Jesus, he's just one of these extra prophets. You know, he's one of three, and that's why God interrupts him. He sort of comes in as Peter is speaking. Another line could be that it's to do with the Feast of Tabernacles that would happen once a year when the Israelites would symbolically kind of go and make little shelters for themselves to remind themselves of the Exodus and of course that Moses took his people out about through and Elijah took people back to constantly remember them, this great salvation that God had worked. And so let's kind of do it. Let's do all that again. Let's have a time of remembering how God has worked in the past in this sort of mini sort of Feast of Tabernacles. But that was as far as I got in my prep.
Do you lean in any direction?
No.
Okay. Does it matter if we're not clear on that?
Well, the reason I didn't go further, and I thought it's not the main road. So
It's if you're interested, PhD perhaps for you in later life. Was Elijah the same person as John the Baptist? You know, you sort of said that, that Elijah was John the Baptist. What's the evidence for that here? Is there evidence elsewhere? Did John understand himself to be Elijah?
So no, Elijah wasn't literally... John the Baptist, sorry, wasn't literally Elijah. They were two different people, but... John the Baptist seems to assume the role of Elijah. I'm taking it there from verse 13. You know, then the disciples understood that he was talking about John the Baptist when he was talking about Elijah. Just asserting that?
Verse 13 is helpful. They wore the same sort of stuff, didn't they? That's another
thing. Good point. Yeah, sort of camel's hair.
And
all
they ate the same sort of things.
Yep.
Really unpleasant things.
Yep.
So there's a lot of things that draws them together.
Yeah.
And Malachi helps us to see sort of some of the Old Testament background for this, some more of the evidence.
So it's Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6 that particularly talk about this coming of Elijah that the prophets were referring to.
Great, thank you. Okay, one point in your sermon, you sort of really pushed us on a number of things that Jesus could be calling us to do, the number of examples of ways in which we might take up our cross and follow him.
Yes.
Somebody just asked, a couple of people asked, you know, how do we know what that is? How do we know what the particular thing is that perhaps Jesus is calling us to do? How do we know whether it's, you know, one of those options you mentioned or something else entirely?
In one sense, I don't know. What's important is you ask the question. What better question could you be asking than, what is Jesus calling with me to do with my life, and I'm willing to obey? That's just a great position to be in. How do we know? Well, we just keep on doing the normal Christian life. We come to church, we listen as his word is taught, we just work through it week by different passages, week by week. We listen, we meet with others, we ask for their help, wisdom and guidance on how this passage might affect our lives, and we obey him. So in a sense, that I don't know the specific thing.
And then sort of following up from that, how do we practically listen to Jesus? We're told to listen to Jesus, to him. You know, how do I know whether I'm doing that? What would it look like in my life? What's the evidence I could present that I really am listening to Jesus?
When we do what someone says, we've listened to them. So when we obey what Jesus says, we're clearly someone who's listening to him. Is the question more where does Jesus speak to us, or how does he speak to us?
How do I listen? I'm so pepped up about listening to Jesus after this sermon, tell me how to do it.
He speaks to us here in his word. So I would just keep going, paying close, opening up the Bible within the week with others here on a Sunday, and seeking just to do what he says. It's so simple, but it's really hard to do. But it's really simple.
If somebody's particularly struggling to know exactly who would be a good person to speak to, somebody, you know, wants to sort of follow up exactly what that means for them, listening to Jesus, who should they go to?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, you could go to gym. Or, you know, speak to small group leaders, Christian friends. It's something we want to be talking about, isn't it? You know, how do you make sure you're listening to Jesus? Find out how people are getting into the Bible. How do people make sure that the Bible isn't just something we look at on Sunday, but something we look at Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc. as well?
Thank you. Yeah.
So let's be just helping each other, because it's hard, isn't it? But wonderfully, God's given us the motley crew around us to help us on that. Jim, thank you very much. We're going to pray now. We're going to go to God to ask his help as we need to soften our lives. And Tony Rivers is going to come and lead us in prayer.